Welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell. This podcast features in-depth explorations into the traditions of yoga, Sanskrit, Indian philosophy, and South Asian religions. Through candid conversations with scholars and practitioners, we will immerse in the latest and most cutting-edge research on all things yoga. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of the Yogic Studies Podcast. In this episode, we will be speaking with Dr. James Mallinson from SOAS, the University of London. This is a particularly special episode for me. As you'll hear, Jim has been a real academic mentor and guru for me throughout my years in graduate school. His work has had a tremendous impact on my own scholarly trajectory, and currently Jim is an external member of my doctoral committee at Harvard. So it was pretty fun to get to interview him in this way, in this slightly more formal context of the podcast, and to learn a little bit more about his story, in addition to discussing his important research on the history of yoga. Dr. James Mallinson is reader in Indology and Yoga Studies at SOAS University of London. His research focuses on the history and current traditional practice of yoga through the methods of philology, ethnography, and art history. He's currently in the final year of the Hatha Yoga Project, a 5-year, 6-person research project on the history of physical yoga funded by the European Research Council. The project's core outputs will be 10 critical editions of Sanskrit texts on physical yoga and 4 monographs on its history and current practice. In addition to numerous articles and chapters, Dr. Mallinson's publications include Roots of Yoga, published by Penguin Classics in 2017 and co-authored with Mark Singleton, and the Kecheri Vidya of Adinatha, a critical edition and annotated translation of an early text on Hatha Yoga, published by Routledge in 2007. The latter is a revision of his doctoral thesis, which was supervised by Professor Alexis Sanderson at the University of Oxford, where Dr. Mallinson also read Sanskrit as an undergraduate, and which you'll hear about in this episode. Dr. Mallinson has spent more than 10 years living in India with traditional ascetics and practitioners of yoga, and at the 2013 Kumbh Mela was awarded the title of Mahant by the Ramanandi Sampradaya, which was documented in a BBC film entitled West Meets East, featuring Jim's childhood friend and actor Dominic West. Highly recommend you check that out if you haven't seen it already. Jim also recently finished teaching an online course for us here at Yogic Studies entitled YS 108, Roots of Hatha Yoga. It was an incredible course and really jam-packed with years and years of research, including lots of unpublished material from the ongoing Hatha Yoga project. This course is now all set up for self-study and folks can sign up anytime. Listeners can receive 20% off the tuition with the promo code JIM20. It's all caps JIM and the number 20. And you can sign up at yogicstudies.com/YS-108. All right. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. James Mallinson. All right, I'm here with Jim Mallinson. Jim, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. Thank you so much for making the time and joining us.
Well, thank you, Seth, for having me on. Great pleasure.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure and honor to have you here. You know, when I created this podcast, thinking about who I wanted to have on here, got kind of a short list, and your name is definitely right at the top. And I'm excited to have you here and learn today, you know, a bit more about your story and to really talk with you about your research and really pioneering scholarship on the history of yoga. So, I mean, I think for about 30 years now, I believe, you've been studying the history of yoga and yogis, been reading Sanskrit texts, you've been traveling with India's holy men. And, you know, I did a bit of research here before today's podcast and looked you up on Wikipedia. And your Wikipedia entry says that you are Sir James Mallinson, 5th Baronet of Walthamstow, a British Indologist, writer, translator, and nobleman. And I think we could probably even add a few more titles to that, couldn't we? Filmmaker, paraglider, father, etc. So you have a number of pretty esteemed titles behind your multitude of names. You're Sir James Mallinson, Dr. James Mallinson, and somewhat more recently, you've also been awarded the title of Mahant. So I wonder if we could kind of use that as a frame, the Sir, the Doctor, and the Mahant, to kind of unpack your story a little bit and tell us, you know, how you came to do the work that you do today, how you became an Indologist, how you became a Mahant.
Okay, well, yeah, I've seen that Wikipedia thing. I don't know who put it on there. It's quite entertaining. So the first one is easiest to deal with, I guess, the Sir, which is purely the result of being born, and being born a boy, of course, in the silly British system. I'm not sure there's many countries left that perpetuate this system, but yeah, so I'm the 5th Baronet, which means that my great-great-grandfather was given this title, and he was, there was a family business making, it was a timber company, made lots of money. He was extremely generous and set up hospitals and libraries and schools and those kind of things, and was awarded the title by the king in 1930, I think, something like that. Mm. And yeah, so it's simply the fact that, you know, when my father died, I inherited the title from him. Mm. It sounds quite funny, probably not to many of your listeners, but in fact, Walthamstow at the time would have been a nice part of Essex outside of London, but now it's kind of, you know, firmly inside London and has got a bit of a reputation. It's quite a sort of tough place. In fact, it's become, of course, it's been sort of, what do they call it? You know, it's been hipsterized recently.
Is that nearby the area where you live now?
No, God, no, I've hardly ever been there. I've only been there once. But my family were, yeah, I should visit it some more. But yeah, the idea of a baronet of Walthamstow is somewhat, sounds a bit funny to most English people. So that's that. Yeah, I had a pretty privileged upbringing. Not quite as rich as people assume I am from being a nobleman, because my great-great-grandfather gave most of his money away, and not many of his successors made much since. And now I'm in academia, so it's really gone downhill. But yeah, so that's that. That's the Sir dealt with. And then Doctor and Mahant, well, I suppose those two are a bit more closely entwined. I was always good at studying at school, but I was a somewhat delinquent student, not particularly inspired. And when it came to choosing what to do at university, you know, I was good enough, I was getting good enough exam grades to go to probably whatever university I wanted to. And so, you know, at the end of the conveyor belt of school, it was, right, I'll try to go to Oxford. Lots of my friends were going, what should I read? And I'd done Latin, double maths and physics as my final subjects at school. Didn't want to do any more of them. I liked Latin, but because I hadn't done Greek, I couldn't do classics. So I got the prospectus for Oxford, looked at that, and I thought, I went through most of the subjects. I got to O for Oriental Studies. And before that, I was like, no, I don't want to do that. Okay, Oriental Studies, that sounds quite interesting. And the main subject, of course, as it still is Chinese. And I went off to Oxford for an open day in Chinese. An open day for Oriental Studies. But the main professor giving the introductory talk was a professor of Chinese, and it was not a very inspirational talk. And I sat there thinking, oh my God, I don't want to do this. And it's a 4-year course rather than a 3-year course. 4 years of this is not what I'm cut out for. And at the end of the talk, he said, if anyone's interested in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit professor is in his study at the end of the corridor. I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose here. Wandered down the corridor. In fact, there were two guys in there. It was Professor Richard Gombrich, and at the time, Mr. Alexis Anderson. Alexis never actually did a PhD, but he at the time was a lecturer. And I got talking to them. I can't actually remember exactly what they said, but they obviously inspired me. And I did a bit more research when I got home, and I realized that knowing Latin would help. And I was already interested in India as well, because we have this practice in the UK where students quite often take a gap year between school, high school, and university. And a friend who was a couple of years older than me, he'd been to India for his gap year, come back, regaled me with stories of what an amazing time he'd had wandering around. And I put two and two together, thought, yeah, Sanskrit, India, why not? And I think it was probably also a bit of a sort of, you know, perverse desire, you know, to do something weird, probably to annoy my parents. I don't know. I was slightly delinquent at that age, I will confess. But of course, you know, I never really looked back. Alexis Anderson, who's in that room at the end of the talk, from the Chinese professor, he ended up becoming my PhD supervisor. I did 3 years of Sanskrit at Oxford. Again, still, I didn't really get that turned on at the time, I have to say. I was still a somewhat delinquent student. If you ask any of the people who were teaching me then, I certainly didn't give it my all, but I managed to get through. But I was still, I'd been in India for 6 or 7 months on my gap year, and it was during that very first trip. So I went off when I was 17, because I'd gone to school early. I left school at 17. And by the end of that trip, I'd had a few sort of meetings with Babas and Sadhus. And at the very end, I spent a couple of weeks in Pahalgam in Kashmir with a bunch of Naga Sadhus who were preparing to go up to Amarnath to do the yatra, the pilgrimage to the ice lingam in the cave at 4,000 meters. I didn't have time. My visa was running out. I didn't have time to go with them, but I got to hang out with them. And that was great. And I just found this, you know, I found the whole thing totally fascinating. And they were, you know, charismatic bunch of ne'er-do-wells. And it was just also part of the whole, you know, I'd studied Latin at school, but it's kind of to the actual society, the myths and legends being depicted have died out. Obviously, it's had a huge influence on our culture. But in India, you know, you can study the Sanskritic tradition and it's still very much alive. These sadhus and yogis, they're wandering around following, you know, the routes that are talked about in the Ramayana or the Mahabharata and that kind of thing. So to be part of this kind of living classical tradition, I found very fascinating. And I, you know, I've been back to India every year since. Basically, I managed to get out normally in the summer vacation from Oxford, and then, I have to try to remember, but I think I then spent, you know, 6 months or a year in India after I finished my BA at Oxford. And in those days, you know, it was extremely cheap as well. You could, in fact, my gap year, I went with a good friend of mine from school called Alex Watson. And we used to compete with each other, actually, about, you know, who could spend the least. I remember we would, you know, someone bought the chai for both of us, we would give each other the 50 paisa back or whatever. And, you know, we would, a good day was when we got by on less than 50 rupees.
And Alex ended up an Indologist too. He was at Harvard teaching Sanskrit for a bit, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And now he's a professor of Indian philosophy at Ashoka University in Delhi. So I joke that that gap year ruined both our lives, you know. It's quite amazing that it had such an effect on it.
That's pretty remarkable, though.
Yeah. I just had a good chat with him, actually. He's locked down in Goa, it's not too bad. I think monsoon's just hit, though, so he can't swim anymore. Anyway, and then, what did I do? I went back to India in 1992, 1993. It spent quite a long time there, and that's actually when I met my guru. I kind of decided, you know, I've been flirting with this whole sadhu world. I've been hanging out with sadhus and yogis in various different places. There's one in particular in a place called Manikaran up in Himachal Pradesh I spent a lot of time with. And then by a weird coincidence, when I was studying Sanskrit in Pune, yeah, one of the summer vacations I went to Pune to do a, you know, an intensive Sanskrit course.
There. Is that at the Deccan College?
No, it was at the University of Pune at the CASS, Center of Advanced Study of Sanskrit. And that was quite mad. So I was then, I was, you know, in the kind of college lodgings for a month or so. Didn't see another Westerner, working reasonably hard on reading Nyaya texts with scholars there, which was great. But I was, you know, I was kind of very much in just locked away from the outside world, it seemed. Then one day I thought, well, I'll, you know, I've heard about this Rajneesh ashram at the other end of the town. It was miles away in Pune, yeah. And I went and then, you know, found the German bakery and all these crazy looking people wandering around in purple robes and stuff. But then got talking. It's a long story.
I know just the spot. I spent a summer there as well.
Right.
Qordaghan Park.
Qordaghan Park, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was quite an eye-opener, you know, having been stuck on campus for a month. But then weirdly, through meeting some people, I discovered that this sadhu that I knew from Himachal was living in Pune, and I ended up moving in with him. And Claudia, my wife, came and joined me, and we ended up staying in the same place as him, and my studies went downhill slightly. But yes, I'd been involved in that whole world, but I decided, you know, I knew, I realized that if I really wanted to know more about it, I'd need to become part of an established tradition, you know, get initiated into a tradition. And so in 92, went to India. That would have been after I'd finished my BA, but before I did an MA at SOAS. I think I was in India for a year or so. And I went to the Kumbh Mela with the intention of finding, you know, becoming part of a tradition. And through a long series of circumstances, strange occurrences, I ended up in one particular camp of Ramanandis, sort of taken in by one sadhu, who was great and was super friendly and everything, but it was almost, he was too accommodating. He was too keen to have a Western disciple. In the broader camp, there was this one sadhu who was living there. The first time I actually really became aware of who he was, or aware of him, he was walked through our camp, and we were sitting around the dhuni, around the fire with Sri Mahant Lakshman Das, whose camp we were at, and someone nudged Claudia, my wife, well, then my girlfriend at the time, and said, "Beware of that sadhu there. If he gets inside you, he'll suck out all your energy." And I was like, "What the hell?" And I knew about Vajroli Mudra from reading texts already at that point, but I didn't, you know, I didn't realize there were still people who did it. And he was this super charismatic guy, you know, with a big tiger skin, and you know, he looked fantastic. He had a whole gang of reprobates hanging out with him, and so we slowly kind of edged towards him. And in the end, yeah, we started hanging out with him more and more. And then my Hindi wasn't brilliant in those days. I mean, I got a vague idea of what was going on, but one evening, suddenly we were whisked off in this car that belonged to one of his, he had this devotee from Indore. So the Kumbh Mela was in Ujjain, this Kumbh Mela. So Indore's the nearest really big town. And this devotee, who was known as Captain Sahib, was a bit, you know, looked like a pirate. He had his peak cap and he had this ambassador car with flames down the side and a big flag pole on the front. And one night we didn't really know what was going on, but we all piled in. So me and Claudia, Babaji, Captain Sahib was driving, and then Chotia, who was this kind of, is Babaji's young disciple, who was only about 10 or 11 at the time, covered in ash, you know, just a loincloth. And we went herring off through the night to Omkareshwar, got there at 1 or 2 in the morning, went down to the river Narmada. It's beautiful. I mean, it's been rather spoilt, Omkareshwar, because they built a huge dam there. I went back with Daniela, actually, just not long ago, and I was rather upset, you know. Sometimes it's best not to go back to these places, but because I ended up spending several months there later on. And anyway, he then initiated us, which involved being given a mantra and a tulsi bead and having a tilak put on our foreheads.
And he then initiated Claudia as well?
Yeah, Yeah. So it wasn't a sadhu initiation. There's kind of two levels of initiation. You know, you get initiated into the sampradaya as kind of a lay devotee. And then I had a couple more initiations, but I never got initiated as a full sadhu. Always sort of lived on in a kind of liminal zone. And then we went back to Ujjain through the night. And we went back. We had been sleeping under a tree as in the camp of Lakshman Das. And then he came to wake us up, because we'd been up all night, so we overslept the next morning. And he came to wake us up. And I remember, you know, he saw that we had still had these tilaks on our foreheads, and he knew what had happened. And he was pretty furious about it. Mm. And so we had to kind of sheepishly gather up all our bits and bobs. And then we moved over to Babaji's tent. And then that was that. And then for the next 10 years, I spent most of the time in India, I suppose, as much time as I could, wandering around with him, which is, you know, incredible. He was incredibly generous and accommodating, and was happy to take us on. And it was wild. It was a fantastic way to learn about India's religious traditions, and very particularly the Ramanandi tradition and the wider yogi ascetic tradition as well. Yeah. So my Babaji's guru was he was very well known amongst his peers. He was called Srimad Prahlad Dasji, and he led a Jamaat for many years, which is like a sort of often understood or translated as a traveling monastery. So he would wander around India, you know, with 50 sadhus, 75 sadhus following him, and cows, and, you know, massive scene. And they would just wander around for years on end like that. And his guru was, well, he had two gurus. It's quite complicated because you can have more than one guru, but one of his gurus was the famous De Raha Baba, who lived in Vrindavan. He was a famous yogi. You can look him up online. You know, there's still loads about him. His tradition carries on. There are successors to him, but he sort of famously lived in this, called a machan, like a raised hut on the banks of the Yamuna in Vrindavan, and film stars and politicians would come for his blessings and so forth. But he was a great yogi, and so he taught yoga to my Dada Guru, Prahlad Dasji Maharaj, who then taught it to my Guruji, and then I learned a few bits, but obviously nothing like what they learned from one another. You know, so my guru, he spent 7 years basically kind of at the foot of his guru's bed nonstop. He was one of the favored disciples. His guru had 75 sadhu disciples, but five kind of primary ones, and Babaji was the youngest and the sort of favorite to a great extent.
Thank you. This is great. You know, a lot of people, I put some questions out to the yogic studies community or asked for some questions for this conversation. And one of the top questions people wanted to hear about was, you could say a little bit about learning yoga from your guru, and kind of just what is that process like? Like, I mean, how would he teach? You know, obviously today we have the idea of the yoga class and going to a shala or something like that. But this world is quite different. Things happen in a much different pace and context. So I wonder if you could just, you know, obviously there's things that you probably can't share, you know, or don't want to, and that's fine. But anything, you know, as is comfortable to share about learning techniques or methods of yoga from your guru.
Mm. Well, I think that, you know, the important thing to remember is that that it's the whole lifestyle. I mean, other people always say this about yoga, I suppose, but really, you know, he wouldn't dissociate diet or dress or, you know, the way you would walk in the mountains or something from the asana practice or the mudra practice, and all of this is all part and parcel of one way of living. He would transmit it to me. You know, as I said, I kind of occupied a liminal state. I've never claimed, even though I may have looked like one, I've never claimed to be a great ascetic or anything like that. So, you know, down to even the simplest things, like how to put on a loincloth. You know, that's pretty key to the way of life. When it comes to, you know, specific yogic techniques, Yeah, we would just have discussions, you know, around the dhuni, around the fire, and he would tell me things, demonstrate things. He demonstrated Vajroli Mudra to me. Obviously, he would do that in private. Certain things he didn't, you know. So yeah, what happened in terms of my academic career is after that, I thought, well, look, I'm really very interested in this, but I've always kept my feet in both camps, basically, and I think that's. Well, I was often tempted to pack it all in and become a Baba, but I had the love of a good woman to hold me back. Mm. I think that'd be for Claudia, God knows what would have happened to me. Maybe I'd have gone off and had a nice time as a Baba. I don't know. It's unlikely. I would have, who knows? But so I never did that, and also kind of intellectually, you know, mentally, I don't think I could have coped with. Purely being a sadhu, you know, the sadhus I hang out with, they to a great extent reject book learning and all of that, you know. So I'm seen as slightly, you know, I was seen as slightly unusual that I was into studying, but I don't think I could have lasted, you know, spent all that time without kind of trying to intellectualize it at the same time. Similarly, I couldn't have done, you know, my academic work without being able to. Well, being inspired by my experiences in India and also being able to kind of relate that to a living tradition. So the two have always feeded off one another and required one another.
Yeah. I mean, that's been my experience as well. I mean, I think, as you know, I mean, my story in some ways is a little bit parallel, you know, in my early 20s, so a little bit later than you, inspired to go off to India, searching out yoga and sadhus and the roots of these traditions in India. I was also traveling with my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, not yeah. Claudia, but Charlotte. And we had a lot of those encounters as well. And it's what inspired me to go on to grad school, to learn Sanskrit, to go on to do this work. I did not, you know, we didn't find the guru. We didn't make it to the Kumbh Mela. We actually just missed one of the Maha Kumbh Melas, like the month before we got there, our first trip. So we didn't take that kind of diksha or initiation. I kind of went into grad school instead. You know, got the university diksha. But it was certainly those experiences that were inspiring, fueling my passion, generating more and more questions. And then also, just to be honest, it was meeting you. And encountering your work, the work of Jason Birch, you know, Mark Singleton. I think we first met in what, like 2011, I want to say, at that AAR in San Francisco.
Yeah.
On the book review panel for Mark's book, Yoga Body. And you gave this great response, and you mentioned at the beginning of your talk how you were all jet lagged because you had just flown in from India. You were up in Himachal Pradesh hanging out with these yogis and sadhus. And you mentioned this Jawalamukhi temple, the Shakti Pita up there. And I was actually just about to go off to India and to Himachal Pradesh the very next week. So I kind of used that as an opportunity to come say hello to you after your talk and thank you so much. You know, fascinating work. Can you give me the name of that temple? And you kindly did, and gave me the information, the location, and said, go check out this yogi named Champanat Ji. I said, okay. I wrote it down. And sure enough, a week later, you know, after long flight and trains and bus and getting way up into the foothills of the Himalayas, really. I mean, Jawalamukhi is pretty out there. We kind of marched up to this temple. I didn't know what to expect. I was thinking, when you said Champanatji, I was thinking of some, I don't know, rotund guru. I don't know, some big guy.
And he's pretty young then, wasn't he?
He was really young. I say was because he passed away untimely, I think in a car accident, right? A few years ago. Really energetic, amazing young guy, Nath Yogi. And in my very broken Hindi at the time, you know, was able to kind of communicate with the yogis at the temple and got to meet him and kind of mentioned your name. He got very excited and he brought me into the temple. They insisted actually that Charlotte wait outside. They didn't allow the woman into the temple. So she was like, go on in, you know, I'm fine out here. I think she took darshan at the Murti. And I go in and he gives me a tour of the, because it's not only a temple there, but they have a little mutta, little monastery, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And he brings me in and he takes me all the way through, shows me all of the, you know, the images, photographs of the lineage, the Nath yogis, images of Gorakhnath and so forth. Brings me all the way back into his little hut, his little room, where his roommate, who was even younger than him, he must have been like 15 or 16. And he's very excited to show me something. He brings me into this room. They have nothing in this room other than just their little bed, their little cot. And then he brings out this little box and opens up this box, and inside are these Polaroid photos. And he's really excited to show this to me. He pulls out, he starts flipping through the photos, and they're different sadhus just hanging out, smoking chillums, photos of just the sadhu life. And then all of a sudden he flips through and there's a photo of a white dreadlocked yogi doing like a forearm balancing posture, today commonly known as Pincha Mayurasana. And I see it's you. And he's pointing to it. And we had this really great laugh and connection. And it was one of these just kind of powerful moments where a lot of things came together, different worlds all kind of come together up in this temple mutta up in the Himalayas. And anyways, I guess I kind of share that story just because,
yeah,
you know, it kind of connects our stories a little bit, but it also, you know, meeting you, learning about your work, and then kind of our relationship striking up there, you were incredibly supportive of my inquiries, my aspirations to go on to grad school. And thank you for you know, even back then saying, yeah, go for it. But also to say, you know, your story and your work, I think, has been tremendously inspiring for myself, but I know for a lot of other people. So, and just to highlight kind of this confluence of your own practice and your experiences on the ground and how that does feed into the scholarship and your academic work.
Yeah. Sorry about the squeaky door. And there's a few squeaky doors at Jwalaji as well. I was back there, in fact, in November. It's such a wonderful place. I spent a night there and wandered around on my own. It doesn't lose its magic at all. And yeah, because I'd had, when I came back in 2011 as well, that is when I'd met Anupnath, who was this yogi.
Oh,
and
right. So
the picture that you saw, I imagine, would have been taken because, and I discussed this when I did the course for yogic studies, I think, with Anupnath, this young yogi.
Yeah,
and I went there, and I, at the time, you know, I was formulating, I was trying to work out, you know, the, not just, you know, the history of physical yoga, but also how it was practiced by the different lineages and so forth. So I was coming to this, you know, coming to this idea that the Naths, and it, the monastery at Jwalaji is a Nath, very much a Nath monastery. And I was coming to this conclusion that they really didn't do much in the way of asana practice. And then I was introduced to him as this Yogi Raj. And I said, oh, yeah, how come he's called Yogi Raj? What's that about? And they said, oh, he can do the 84 asanas, Chaurasya asana. Okay. And so I was intrigued anyway. And I wanted him to, you know, show me what he could do. And then, so I had to jump through a few hoops. He was quite demanding. He, you know, made me smoke a few chillums, then made me do various asanas, you know, so I pulled my best asanas out of the bag. And then he did his,
in that order.
His display. Yeah, in that order. Yeah. And in that order. And then whilst he was doing his display, probably Champanath, I can't remember who, someone decided to put some of this awful banging techno music on over the sort of monastery loudspeaker system. It was very bizarre. And I just sat there sort of seeing my whole world dissolve in front of me, you know, everything I've been making up or trying to work out, you know, I thought was completely wrong until then afterwards when I asked him about it. And basically it turned out, you know, he hadn't learned it from an art guru. He got it from, I think basically from, you know, from Westerners and looking online and so forth.
Yeah, that's so really interesting, actually. That was a great moment in the course that you recently taught. So this not yogi, he claims 84 asanas, but when we look at the practice that he's doing, right, these asanas, we really don't have any prior history of most of them. And actually, it's funny because Champanath and his roommate, they had like really nothing other than, you know, just a couple possessions. But after, you know, as I was leaving, his roommate pulled out his iPad and they clearly had Wi-Fi and the internet, and he had his iPad and he pulls up his Facebook account and he's asking me if I'm on Facebook, you know, and we added each other as friends on Facebook right there. And so although they had very limited material possessions, they had enough and they had access to this technology. So they were being exposed to, you know, the global conversations, to, and surely aware of, you know, modern postural yoga, global yoga, and that sort of thing. So your hunch was that Anupnath, that he was being influenced by modern yoga?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, as you say, the fact that they've got, I don't think it's that surprising. Sadhus have always, you know, kept up with the latest technology, I think. But it sort of makes me think as well that when I, so actually to take the story back, you know, my story back, I then at the end of, I did an MA at SOAS. I had a year in India, I think, between finishing my BA, maybe it's 2 years actually. I might have gone, disappeared for 2 years. I definitely was quite AWOL for a while. Oh, sorry about that. And then I did this MA at SOAS, and my major then was ethnography. So anthropology, you know, looking into the sort of sociological, ethnographic, anthropological history of sadhus. And I did it on the Ramanandis. Actually, I did my dissertation was on the Ramanandis. And I was trying to argue then, in fact, for the importance of these more, you know, more kind of wild, out there antinomian sadhus. And the name of the title of the thesis was taken from a Paul Brunton book, his book A Search in Secret India, and the title was Some Common Fakirs of an Inferior Order, because he included in that book a picture of some, you know, what I could tell were really quite pucker Ramanandi sadhus, and he was dismissing them. So at that stage, you know, when my kind of drive was to try and bring these types of yogis and ascetics, you know, rehabilitate them to some extent in the academy. I'll get to my point that gets back to Anupnath and Champanath and so forth. So after that, I then decided that I was hooked on academia, but I wasn't that hooked on anthropology, particularly at that time. I think it was very bogged down in theory and stuff. So I thought, okay, I want to go back to using my Sanskrit to continue my studies, and I want to do a PhD. And at that time, Alexis Sanderson was in Oxford and was surrounded by, you know, an amazing bunch of students there. It was the place to go and the thing to do. You know, what he was very much promoting through his own scholarship and through his teaching, textual criticism. So the, you know, the editing of previously unpublished texts from manuscripts. So that's what I wanted to do. You know, it was great because it would involve having to go to India as well to go and find the manuscripts. Plus, I also then included some field work into my project because I had to choose a text, right? And this, you know, I didn't realize that really the significance of this at the time. I wasn't completely, you know, I wasn't totally focused on yoga in terms of my work at the time. But then in order to find a text, you know, the only Sanskrit texts that really were of any relevance to this world that I was fascinated by were the ones on yoga, on Hatha yoga in particular, you know, because the rest of the stuff they do, the rest of that world is not really, there's very little in Sanskrit texts that will, you know, that teaches you how to live like a wandering sadhu. I mean, there are some Brahmanical stuff, but, you know, some old kind of Dharma Shastra materials, but they're not really that relevant and not, they weren't particularly what I was interested in. So I settled on, there'd been a monograph written by a brilliant French scholar, very generous, erudite Frenchman called Christian Bouy, actually, which is in the process, I think it's pretty much been translated into English more than 25 years on. And so this is an amazing book. And he identified, that's the first kind of really pucker, comprehensive or, large scale philological study of Hatha Yoga texts. There'd been a bit of previous stuff, some P.K. Gode, for example, in India, there's been some stuff. Gode, I don't remember, is it Gode? It's Gode, I think. But anyway, there'd been some stuff in India, but this is the first big kind of comprehensive, survey of the field. And he identified, I went through that trying to find texts that he'd mentioned, a text that would be suitable for me to work on. So I settled on this text called the Khechri Vidya, which had been, it's quoted in the Hatha Pradipika, so it's relatively old. It was, and it's about the Khechri Mudra, this yogic technique. So what I then needed to do was go to India, A, to find manuscripts of the text and to collate, to produce a critical edition and translation. But also, I wanted to illuminate that study with field work, and particularly, it teaches this relatively esoteric practice of turning your tongue back above your palate and thereby stimulating kundalini and drinking the nectar of immortality that is being released from the top of the skull. And so I spent 6 months, I think my first trip to India as part of the PhD, I was both visiting libraries to find manuscripts, but also looking for yogis who practice the technique. In 6 months, following various leads from my guru and chance leads here and there, Rishikesh, a couple of things turned up. And I think I found 6 or 7 practitioners. And of course, now you just Google it and you'll find, you'll get direct link, you'll get people demonstrating it to you all over YouTube. And, there's long online discussions about what's the best kind of cuticle scissors for cutting the tendon at the base of the tongue to make your tongue longer and things like that. But in those days, there's absolutely no option but to go to India and find, track down people who did it. So in that respect, the internet has really, like it with everything, it's revolutionized everything. But it's the way it brings together, you can, people with these very niche interests, which has obviously is good and bad results. But
So the Khechri Vidya, which you edited for your dissertation, is a key Sanskrit text that teaches this method?
Yes, exactly. It's the one text that's solely devoted to that technique. But of course, when students come to me wanting to do theses or particularly doctoral studies, I try to say to them, I try to encourage people to do something very focused, because that's the great thing, and you know this from your work as well, but to have a, particularly with a text, have a defined project, that defines your project. But also just by looking, looking at this one thing, this one practice of Khechri Mudra. So just to understand that one practice, I had to understand so many other things. And luckily, I was in the perfect place for it. A, for this kind of methodological process of editing a text, of, going out and getting photographs of the manuscripts and collating them and editing the text and so forth. But also because it was clearly produced in a milieu of tantric Shaivism, and of course Alexis is the greatest living scholar of tantric Shaivism, so he was able to help me situate it within that world. I was able to complement it with my ethnographic findings, but I think it's always the best approach is to concentrate on one small thing and try to contextualize it, rather than come to, a student comes to me and says, I want to write a history of alchemy and tantra, you're just going to go mad because you'll never stop as well. It's completely unlimited. I had to get a crash course in tantric Shaivism and also situate it within the world of yoga scholarship up to that point as well.
So tell us a little bit about working under Professor Alexis Sanderson then to do this project. For anybody who doesn't know, Dr. Alexis Sanderson, I guess Professor Alexis Sanderson rather, from Oxford. I mean, his textual work on the history of Tantra, Tantric Shaivism, but even more broadly, just on religion in medieval India has really radically shaped our understanding of Tantra, Shaivism, the history of India through very, very painstaking philological work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, what is unique about Sanderson's approach and what that was like kind of being trained under him, reading these sort of texts with him.
I mean, I wouldn't say that his approach is unique. It's just that he's, one of the foremost examples of applying it, the philological method. And he's written one of his many, so many great articles, but there's one that's history through textual criticism, I think it's how it's called. So, how you use the study of text to understand the history of a tradition. And he, to some extent, I suppose, like me, although he's always been, he's a scholar's scholar. I'm a scholar's scholar. The tradition that he immersed himself in was very scholarly as well. So this kind of last dying embers of a living tradition of Kashmir Shaivism. And that's what inspired him. And he spent 7 years in Kashmir living with his teacher, Swami Lakshmanju, who was a brilliant practitioner and, he had great knowledge of that vast textual tradition. And Alexis, since then, so that was around 1970, I think, that he first went to Kashmir. He's devoted his life and career to this huge corpus of Sanskrit texts on Tantra more broadly, but specifically the Shaiva aspects as well. That's what his focus has been. So that has involved him again. The field that I work in, and maybe we'll talk a bit more about this later, but it's a much more kind of bounded and smaller, the world of Sanskrit texts on Hatha Yoga, mm-hmm. particularly the sort of early period that I work on is not a huge corpus, whereas the corpus of Tantric texts, even if you have a cutoff at sort of 10th or 11th century, is vast. Mm-hmm. And the vast proportion, the vast majority of them are unpublished and only exist in, well, that's changing, but generally only exist in manuscripts. So he has spent the last 50 years working from manuscripts of these tantric texts, trying to piece together the history of the tradition and how the tradition worked. That differs quite a lot from the Hatha Yoga tradition in that it's much more intellectual, it's much more intellectualized, it's much more philosophical as well. And so he has, he's blazed a trail, and he's had lots of students who have continued and colleagues who have, worked under him and then with him, and the field has really opened up. Working with him, he was brilliant, perfect for me, the perfect doctoral supervisor. In that when I was in Oxford, and he would have, he'd be reading texts. Of course, that was the. That's the best thing to do. It gets certainly my university, it's harder and harder. No one has the time or the energy now just to sit around and spend hours just reading text together. So he would, each term he would be reading something, and if I was around, I would go along to these reading sessions and so forth. But in terms of supervision, he was reasonably hands off, I suppose. Nowadays, I think. Certainly in the States, and also at SOAS now, where I work, the early years of a PhD are quite structured, and you have to do lots of coursework and so forth, and go to these different seminars on research methods and blah, blah, blah. I had none of that. Mm-hmm. I just got on with it. In fact, I cleared off pretty quickly to India for 6 months, and I probably didn't check in even when I was in India. And then when I wasn't on field work, I would just work for a month or so, and get a bunch of questions, prepare a section of text that I was working on to edit, and then I'd arrange appointment with him, and I'd go and sit with him for a few hours. And he was always there. You know, he just he's a kind of fixture at All Souls in this wonderful old college in Oxford. He had this great set of rooms and just turn up, and he was always there. It's like a, you know, you knew he was going to be there. I'd fix the time, and then I'd go and sit and read with him. And he was quite, I remember once, because obviously he was my undergraduate tutor as well, and I do remember one particular time that I turned up and I was meant to have written an essay, and I said, sorry, I haven't, I haven't got around to writing it. I haven't finished it yet. And he just said, well, come back next week. That was it. Sort of shut the door on me. That was great. You know, perfect. It was sort of no small talk, no messing around.
No. No, yeah. If you're going to show up, you have to have done the work.
Exactly.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I think, that model of the PhD, as you know, is quite different in the States in terms of coursework and structure and teaching and, all kinds of hoops that we have to jump through, as you know, from helping to supervise my PhD. But I think, that... just let's look at the facts, let's just get down to business, let's just sit here for hours and hours and read through the manuscripts, I think that in some ways the sort of purity of that method has now really been taken forth from that world of the tantric texts now into this corpus of Hatha Yoga texts by yourself, by Jason Birch and other colleagues. And since then, you've had the great fortune to lead this Hatha Yoga project. And we're now coming up, at the end of this 5-year project. Is that right?
I know. It's rather depressing. It's hanging over me.
Sorry to, not to remind you of the fatal end here.
Obviously, got lots of things
come to an end.
Yep. All good things come to an end. I think we might get a little extension of those, not everyone else, but I think in terms of finishing the outputs because of COVID, it's held a few things up. But that's been amazing. In fact, just today, I had a 2-hour session with, we're doing it twice a week at the moment. We're reading Jason Birch and Mark Singleton are working on an edition of the asana section of the Hatha, a text called the Hatha Sanketa Chandrika, which is 18th century, I think. In 2 hours, I think today was reasonably productive and we read maybe 5 verses or 6, And the text isn't in that bad a state either, but it's in today's kind of, neoliberal world or whatever, where the universities are certainly over here seem to function as businesses and, everything's got to be time pressurized and where you're getting your value for money. It doesn't, if you explain to people this is what you're doing, they'll go crazy. But luckily, we got lucky with this big grant and we're able to do it. And it's the only way to do it, There's one verse today that was really tricky and we looked at it. There were probably, we're obviously doing it on Zoom now and there were these kind of deathly silences for like half a minute or a minute when no one would say anything. And we go, maybe it could be this instead, because of course, we're working from manuscripts. Manuscripts have mistakes in or copying errors or, and you're trying to make sense of it. There's one verse, it took us ages, but in the end, I think we got there. And had we not had the freedom to just to sit there and reflect upon it for, we probably spent half an hour on that verse. It's only 4 lines. We'd never have cracked it. So yeah, it's the only way to do this work. I'm quite pessimistic that it's not going to be around that much longer. I don't know. I think that interestingly at the moment the will is there from the funding bodies. They recognize the importance of this work. But the problem we're going to see is that the way universities are working, I don't know quite how it is in the States, but it's becoming harder and harder to produce students who are equipped with the skills to do this kind of work. The courses, the sort of foundational courses, are disappearing.
Well, I wanted to say, I've had the fortune to participate in some of those text reading workshops with you guys, and they're phenomenal. I mean, it takes creating that time and space in your schedule and life to be able to just sit there with the text, but the privilege to be able to do that, it's really the only way to really understand what's going on in these texts. And one thing that's always struck me about just being in those spaces is how collaborative that process is, that there'll be a team, or, you know, at least two or three or more scholars who are reading together and thinking together and reading across vast, corpus of texts. And I think that's really important to highlight, just the collaborative process of this work. And I think, you know, something like the Hatha Yoga Project brings that out, because it really is a team of scholars that are working together, bringing all of their various expertise to look at, you know, one line or one word in a text together.
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, I think that sort of, yes, and that picks up on what I was saying earlier about with my PhD, for example. You know, you have, there's so many different things that you have to bring to bear upon just trying to understand a little bit of text, you know, and to do that collaboratively makes it even better. You know, like we had that Amrita Siddhi workshop in Italy. I mean, you know, there, because there we had to bring in not just textual scholars, but then the, you know, experts in Tantric Buddhism, Tantric Shaivism, in Hatha Yoga, you know, and no one person can really master all those different fields. So by bringing together different people, and then there are people like, so when I've been reading this Hatha Sanketa Chandrika, none of us are particularly good on Sanskrit meter, whereas Shaman Hatli, who we're working with, he's very good at it. And so, you know, that's pretty crucial as well, particularly the text we're working on has some quite interesting metrical forms. So, yeah, as you say, you want to bring in, you know, you need a team of all the talents that's covering all the different bases.
Yeah. I'm feeling that very much right now as I'm slowly, slowly editing my text. I could use Shaman and yourself and other people.
Well, we should have a session on it.
Yeah, we should. I mean, I've been saying that for a while, so it's on me. It's on me to get that together. So let's move forward a little bit, though. Let's talk more about the Hatha Yoga Project. Let's talk about the research and what you've been finding. But let's start really simple. What is Hatha Yoga? Let's say it's non-COVID times and you're on a plane flying somewhere to a conference, and you sit next to someone, you strike up a conversation, just your average person, and they ask what you do. You say, "Oh, I'm a scholar of Hatha Yoga." They'll say, "What is that?"
What is that? You see, well, I'm going to have to write a monograph on the whole thing, but the short answer. The short answer, I say it is something like a variety of yoga in which physical techniques predominate, or something. You know, which the techniques are primarily physical. The sort of slightly longer answer is that it's the form of yoga in which physical methods are used in order to achieve, you know, spiritual states, higher states of mind, and eventually liberation. And it first appears in our textual material record about 1,000 years ago. So that's what I've been studying. Just to take it back, just to also introduce the project a little bit as well.
Yeah.
What I found when I was doing my PhD, it became pretty apparent to me that the received understanding of the history of Hatha Yoga didn't really match with what I was seeing in texts, also with what I was seeing in amongst practitioners, traditional practitioners in India. And I realized that basically you need to go back to square one, you need to look at all the texts again, that a lot of these texts none of these texts really had been properly edited. Because also in the process of editing a text, you know, it forces you to understand its historical context better. So I realized that's what needed to be done. And I realized after a while that I wasn't going to be able to do it all in one lifetime. And then I formulated, you know, this idea to do a big research project on it. And that bounced around for a few years. I think I did put a proposal in 2012, maybe 2013, with Alexis actually as the PI, but I didn't have a job then. You see, it's quite difficult to do these applications when you don't have a university position. So it wasn't until I then, and the project got very good reviews, in fact, the application then with Alexis, but I think probably they sussed out that, you know, he wasn't going to be doing that much on it, and it was me, and, you know, they perhaps didn't trust me at that point. And then as soon as I got the job at SOAS in 2013, you know, within a few months, I think I put in my application for the ERC. And that came good. But yeah,
which is essentially like winning the academic lottery, isn't that right?
Sure. Yeah, it's much the biggest grants around in Europe, and I don't think you've got anything comparable in the States, have you?
I don't think so. Not at that level.
So that money enabled me not to have to do any teaching, and then also to employ Daniela, Jason, and Mark on the team, and then also researchers in India as well. It's huge amount of resources. It's very luxurious.
Yeah, and over the past 5 years, you've been doing, you know, along with team members, quite a bit of field work, trips and journeys to India. We actually had Daniela on the podcast recently. She shared quite a bit about her experiences and some of her field work as part of the project. You've also been traveling to libraries, archives, unearthing more and more manuscripts. And you've written a number of articles and chapters, in the last really like 10 years. But now you're kind of coming to the end of the project, and you're starting to really kind of write everything up. And I understand you're working on a monograph. You've probably been saying that for many years. It's great to get to kind of check in with you about this, have this conversation at the tail end of this project. I'd like to just kind of ask a few just kind of basic questions, like, are there any major discoveries or surprises, things that you were not expecting to find? I mean, you clearly, even, you know, before this, you've been doing this work for decades. So it's not as if this suddenly began 5 years ago for you, but were there certain assumptions you had going in, anything that sort of surprised you over the past 5 years, or that has changed your thoughts about anything?
Yes. And if it hadn't been, it would have been a waste of time, wouldn't it? But yeah, but obviously there are different grades of surprises. And much the biggest, I think, the one that, you know, completely unexpected and that has then shaped a lot of my work since, was the realization that the first text, the earliest text that teaches Hatha Yoga, this text called the Amrita Siddhi, which I first started working on, I think 2007, 2008, I started looking at manuscripts of it that I got in Jodhpur. But then we got hold of a manuscript or scans of a manuscript from probably from Tibet that was housed in Beijing. And through reading that one closely, it became apparent that this text that everyone had assumed was produced by tantric Shaivas, so, you know, Hindu tradition in India, was written by tantric Buddhists. Mm. My work of the last few years, a lot of it has focused on trying to make sense of that, how that could have happened, and, you know, how this transition came, because the subsequent texts are all clearly not tantric Buddhist. The Amrita Siddhi was written probably 11th century. And all the subsequent texts, many of which draw directly on it or paraphrase it, they were not written by tantric Buddhists. So yeah, a lot of work, not just textual as well, it's been really good fun. You know, one point Daniela and I, so it was fairly early on in the project as well, thankfully, that we realized this. And so I was kind of trying to track down sites where this may have happened, you know, where there could have been this kind of exchange or transformation from tantric Shaivism to tantric Buddhism. I think the craziest part of that trip was, or trying to, you know, the field work involved with that was getting a boat, you know, riding out in a little boat off the Karnataka coast to this tiny island, which happened to have a sort of jungle camp on it where you could go and stay. So that we went and spent the night there, hoping that it might be this island that was mentioned by the Tibetan scholar Taranatha around 1600, where he talks about these Buddhist monks in wearing black and getting drunk all the time. And it was slightly disappointing, though. It didn't come to anything because as soon as we got there, we could see that there's they was hoping we might find some old ruined temple or something. And it wasn't necessarily the island. There are other islands about, but this one was a pretty good candidate. But all the boatmen, all the locals informed us that all of the islands around there had these Portuguese fortifications on, and there was a big sort of wall all around the one we went to. It was called Gurumgard, I think, the one we went to. And then I looked further into it, and it became apparent that, you know, the Portuguese had arrived around 1500. Mm-hmm. And so there was no way that Taranatha could have been, or it was actually the words of his guru, Buddha Gupta Natha, but there was no way the timeline worked that that there could have been Buddhist there, because the Portuguese trashed all temples and kicked everyone off and so forth. But then digging around a bit further, it became apparent that it was pretty likely that Taranatha was getting his sources confused, and in fact, by these bibulous, drinking, black-clad priests, he meant Jesuit priests, not Buddhists. Mm. So that was quite funny when we worked that one out. But yeah, there's an article I published last year called Karla Vanchner in the Konkan, mm-hmm. Have put together what I think is a reasonably likely scenario in which this transition from Tantric Buddhism to Tantric Shaivism occurred.
So as this relates to the emergence of Hatha Yoga, what is sort of your current thinking about how and where this thing called Hatha Yoga emerges?
Well, so this thing called Hatha Yoga, so an article I've got in press, should be out very soon, looks into the early history of the term Hatha Yoga, and it's building on an article that Jason published a long time ago now, I think it's 2011, called The Meaning of Hatha, again looking at this same question. So what I think happened is that the practices taught in the Amrita Siddhi, which are not all encompassing of physical yoga practice by any means, is these three specific practices, Mahamudra, Mahabandha, and Mahaveda, but then they are taught within this very comprehensive, coherent understanding, description of the yogic body and the processes which go on within the body in the course of yoga practice. But that, in a subsequent text, Shaiva Nath text called the Amaraga Prabodha, so I think the author of that text, he then takes this term Hatha Yoga, which in fact originates in Tantric Buddhist sexual ritual, meaning the restraint of orgasm by the male partner in the ritual. He takes that term, which kind of has some, the concept has some applicability to the yoga of the Amrita Siddhi, in that the yoga of the Amrita Siddhi is all about, being a celibate yogi. A lot of it is about preserving what's called bindu within the text. Mm-hmm. And so the author of that text, he takes the term Hatha Yoga, applies it to the techniques in the Amrita Siddhi, and then it has its own life after that, the term Hatha Yoga. It gets expanded more and more, and by about 1400 we get to the Hatha Pradipika, which uses it, so it means that the name of the text means the light on Hatha. And in that text, the term is used to denote kind of physical yoga practice much more broadly. So it specifically identifies the stages of Hatha practice as asana, so postures. And it's the first text to teach, as part of Hatha Yoga, these kind of complex non-seated or balancing postures and so forth. Then also includes different methods of breath control, breath retention. And then these mudras, so like the Khetri Mudra I was talking about earlier, various different techniques for manipulating the vital energies, and also adds Nada Anusandhana, which is concentration on the inner sound. And a lot of those practices, I don't think, originated within Tantric Buddhism. Okay, so I'm not trying to say that physical yoga practice came from Tantric Buddhism, but Tantric Buddhism was key in its early development and absolutely central to its kind of textual codification. But we can see that other practices that become included in under the rubric of Hatha Yoga, such as these complex methods of inhalation and exhalation, or the balancing postures, and some of the mudras, so like inverted postures for headstands and so forth, they seem to come from what we now use the blanket term Hindu tradition to describe. So, yeah, I feel that. covered it.
Yeah. now today, you know, when it, like, at least in modern postural yoga, when people think of hatha yoga or hatha yoga, as it's often said, you know, that kind of hatha yoga, which we might distinguish from hatha yoga, that hatha yoga is often taught as, and as it differentiates, let's say, from other postural yoga schools as slightly more meditative, maybe holding poses for a little bit longer, sometimes even as more therapeutic or kind of easy or relaxing rather than like a more vigorous vinyasa type flowing yoga practice. And I think, you know, I think we've talked about this before, but I think it's somewhat ironic in that the term hatha means force or violent, or if used adverbially, forceful. So, you know, I wonder if you could just say a little bit about the meaning of the term hatha. You've kind of shared about how this term kind of has arisen and then is used to be applied to these sets of physical practices. But what's with this notion then of hatha as violent or forceful? And how does that differ from other kind of popular notions of, say, hatha yoga as the union of sun and moon, ha and ta?
Okay, well, that, yeah, that definition comes in quite a bit later. In fact, in our recent work, so Jason in particular has been working on the Yoga Bija, which is the text where that verse is found, but through looking at its manuscripts, it's become clear that there are two recensions of it, and that that verse about the ha and ta being the sun and the moon is in the later recension, so it's probably, you know, it's no older than 16th century, I think, at the earliest. Could even be later than that. And that, I think, to some extent was that verse is an attempt to kind of deflect from the negative connotations of this idea of hatha as meaning force, you know, or as you say, almost violence. Because that really is another key discovery, I think. It wasn't really a discovery, and it was staring in our faces all the time, I think, but through the project, which really came to the fore because of Daniela's ethnographic work, is the understanding of the term hatha yoga, you know, in current parlance, not just amongst ascetics, but very particularly among ascetics. You know, it means doing these really extreme things, extreme practices, such as, you know, these sort of bodily mortifications of, you know, standing up for years on end, or that kind of thing. So if you know, if you go to the Kumbh Mela and you hear that there's a hatha yogi somewhere, it doesn't mean he's, you know, he's doing gentle posture practice. It means he is probably, and I say he, I don't think there's many people calling themselves hatha yoginis. It means he'll be, in fact, my uncle Guru he's known as a hatha yogi, and that's because he, you know, he has throughout the cold season, he gets up in the middle of the night and has 108 massive pots of freezing cold water poured over his head. That's what makes him a hatha yogi. So this, and I think this is something I'd like to look into more. I'm sure I often wonder if work's been done on this, but the kind of interplay between vernacular terminology and Sanskrit terminology, because I suspect that part of the reason, in fact, there's quite a lot of texts that teach this kind of physical yoga which don't use the term hatha. I think that may be because they don't like this connotation of sort of force or, you know, uncomfortableness or danger. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also partly the reason behind, you know, this ha-ta definition. Funny enough, I mean, Mark and I, we had a plan, and we never got around to it, actually, but we were going to, you know, when he explained to me about this notion of what hatha yoga is in modern yoga practice, we kind of, you know, I thought there's quite a good pun to be made about the difference between hatha and hatha, in which the hatha is because there's the dot, you know, underneath the T, and the word for a dot in Sanskrit is bindu. Okay, so we're going to, you know, try, the idea is that the difference between the hatha and the hatha is all about the bindu, because obviously it's not all the emphasis on the bindu dharana, or the retention of semen within the hatha practice. All about, yeah, so that's all. It's all quite, quite complicated, the interplay between the terminology there. Yeah.
Well, speaking about Bindu, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about is, you know, who do we think was doing these types of practices? What can we glean from the historical record about the yogi or the yogin? And, you know, in a series of articles, chapters from, I'd say, about 2011 to 2014 that you put out, you argued that, you know, in this corpus of Hatha Yoga texts, that yoga, you know, one of the things that sort of shifted is that yoga was no longer only practiced by male celibate ascetics, and that there was, at least with the rhetoric in the text, this kind of universalism that is espoused, that anybody can do the practice as long as they do the practice, and even perhaps a growing shift towards householders. Actually, I'd like to read this quote, if you don't mind, from your 2014 article. There's always the risk that you've completely thrown away these ideas, but
I like it.
So we'll see if this still holds up. But I've always liked this quote. I've used it in some of my own work before. But you wrote that Mircea Eliade, you know, really early pioneering scholar of yoga, Eliade declared the period from the 4th century BCE to the 4th century CE to be the triumph of yoga. Yet yoga's true triumph came during the first half of the 2nd millennium CE. It is then that, thanks to the composition of the Hatha Yogic corpus, yoga's practices ceased to be the preserve of ascetics or initiates into tantric cults. And go on, but, you know, became slightly more mainstream. So now, 6 years later from when you wrote that, just be curious to hear a little bit about your latest thoughts on who do you think was actually doing this yoga? And we might also add, who was then writing the Sanskrit texts on yoga?
Okay, well, I'm relieved that I'm not completely shocked. I haven't completely rejected what's in that quote. I still stand by that, because I think it is that period that, by the end of it, you know, by the 15th century, we see that the mainstream religious traditions, Brahmanical traditions in particular in India, are, you know, developing a much greater interest in yoga. Around the 12th century, 13th century, we had this in a SOAS lecture last week, but we were discussing this. That's when yoga first appears as one of the darshanas, you know, one of the six traditions, or six important approaches of Indian philosophy. And then, right, you know, 15th, 16th, 17th century, then it becomes really quite mainstream and is incorporated within the Upanishads and so forth, new Upanishads. But what I have not changed my mind, I don't think, particularly. I mean, I have changed my mind on one thing. I'm not so convinced about the position of householders, or that there were many householders doing yoga as we see taught in the text. I mean, I haven't got a, you know, definite answers to this. And of course, you know, there are certain texts that instantly spring to mind, like the Shiva Sanghita, that make it very clear that they are for regular householders living in, you know, living normal lives. But we have no material or external, I mean, I suppose we're unlikely to have material evidence, but we have pretty much, I mean, we have, to my knowledge, we have no evidence outside of those texts of householders doing yoga until the modern period. I think I came across one reference to some Mughal noblemen, you know, wanting to find out about Vajrayana Mudra so that they could improve their love lives. Other than that, you know, I haven't come across any kind of historical reports or anything of anyone other than professional ascetics doing yoga.
What about like Brahminical, you know, Brahmin priests and Dharmashastra literature doing pranayama?
Okay. There's a bit of that, isn't there? And it's part of certain rituals. And in particular, I think in some southern temple texts, you know, the priests are instructed to do a bit of yoga. But through, it seems fairly perfunctory, and I think it's, who's it, Madame Brunet, Hélène Brunet, she's written about this, or she wrote about this, and she points out that, you know, she combined it with some ethnographic fieldwork, if I remember correctly, and she says that, you know, none of the priests actually do any yoga. You know, when it comes to that bit of pranayama and sitting in postures and stuff, they just quickly brush it over and so forth. So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that's possible, and that could possibly benefit from some more field work from people looking more deeply into that. But what I've, a sort of a new theory that I've got, which I will be trying to justify and make sense of in my monograph, and you've seen a draft article of this about this already, but the production of the texts themselves has always kind of confused me. And I, it was through reading a book by Manu David Devan, who's, is it Hinduism? I can't remember the name of the title.
Is it A Prehistory of Hinduism?
A prehistory of Hinduism. No, hang on. Isn't that, was that him? Or is that Asko Parpola?
Well, no, this is, Manu David Devan.
Manu David Devan. Okay, thank you. Thank you for reminding me. Exactly. So he really, it really inspired me reading that book. And it made me reflect upon the role of monasteries in propagating the Hatha Yoga tradition, and what it made me realize, or made me think about, was how that the period of production of these texts, this Hatha Yoga corpus, particularly the early corpus that I've been working on, that coincides with the kind of rise to prominence and power of monastic traditions within India, in particular in the Deccan and South India, and it seems to be that a lot of the texts come from those regions as well, and that answered a lot of questions, you know, a lot of questions that have been bothering me about the texts themselves, you know, about what was going on. You know, if, you know, they do, as you mentioned, they generally espouse a kind of universalism. They don't bang a particular sectarian drum. And apparently, and I should probably look more into this, but apparently the texts that, you know, the various different monasteries, which would be from different religious traditions, you know, there's dozens of them, they would be churning out their own texts about all kinds of different subjects. And the monasteries functioned a bit like universities as well. So students who would be young Brahmin men would be able to travel between them and go to, you know, a certain monastery had a reputation for being very good on yoga, I suppose. There was a good teacher about Hatha Yoga, they'd go there. So that kind of answered the questions of, A, why this kind of espousal of universalism? Why they say anyone can practice yoga? Doesn't matter what religious tradition you're part of. Why the text in Sanskrit? Because Sanskrit was the lingua franca of these universities, these monasteries. Because again, you know, if the earlier idea I had of, you know, these suddenly yoga was being put to the wider world beyond ascetics. But then why teach in Sanskrit? You know, we know about the general move from starting around that period towards vernacularization. Well, surely if you're going to be producing yoga texts for the general public, for all and sundry, you'd be producing them in vernacular.
Right. There's a few vernacular texts that start to crop up, but nothing compared, at least what we have.
Yeah, and they're not really manuals either.
Right.
Maybe we should say a bit more about that in a minute. But also the third thing also really, you know, explained again why women hardly get a look in these texts as well. You know, we know from certain sources that there were, even within the, you know, one or two references within the text and then from some external references as well, we know that there were female yoginis around, but they really don't get a look in the text. And I think that's because they were products of, you know, monasteries for male celibate students, basically.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I think, you know, as you just mentioned, a lot of these mathas, these monasteries, were in South India. They're in the area, you know, usually termed the Deccan of Karnataka, Andhra Pradesh, Maharashtra, that kind of broader Deccan, South India. And would you say that that's been one of the important findings as well of the project in your work? Because really, I would say previous generations of scholarship, or if you, you know, kind of look at literature on yoga prior to a lot of the work that you've been doing, kind of the traditional scholarly narrative has been that Hatha Yoga was developed or invented by the Nath yogis. and more that Hatha Yoga and the knots resided mostly in the north, where today they're most prevalent, northern and eastern India and even Nepal. And so I think there has been an assumption that a lot of this yoga and even Hatha Yoga came from the north. But it seems like there's growing evidence, and my own work, as you know, is looking at this as well, of Hatha Yoga developing in the south, that we see evidence of both in the texts, in the sculpture, material record. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and the importance perhaps of pinning down, you know, the geography of where this may have been happening during the beginning of the second millennium CE.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good point. I'll remember that next time I'm asked about the big discovery. Funny enough, in fact, when I applied for the funding for the project, I then, you know, I got through to the second round, which meant I had to go to Brussels for an interview. And one of the questions I was asked at the interview, one of the ones that slightly threw me, most of them I was quite well prepared for, was, you know, why is there so little focus on South India in your proposal? Mm-hmm. I can't actually remember what I said in reply, but I remember thinking that's a good point. Mm-hmm. And ironically, we ended up, you know, as you say, identifying the South and the Deccan as very important sites in the, you know, early history of Hatha Yoga. And I'm more and more convinced, something I need to work on a bit more, particularly the Hatha Pradipika as well, you know, so there's texts from probably 15th century or maybe 1400, as early as 1400, that I'm more and more convinced, but basically on the name, because of the list of siddhas that it gives, there's a lot of them are only mentioned elsewhere in South Indian texts. Mm-hmm. And as you've seen in that draft article, that has been a big revelation. What we can say more broadly, I mean, I suppose, I don't really know. I'm sort of reluctant to conjecture too much about it, but I don't know, you know, the bigger picture, of course, Islam was moving into North India during this period, whether mm-hmm. that's a factor, I'm not really sure, but yeah, there's the evidence textual, and as you say, material, which I think is very important, points to these early Hatha Yoga traditions all being from no further north than, well, possibly Gujarat, I suppose. Yeah, not, you know, there's a bit going on in Gujarat, maybe. But yeah, from then the Deccan Plateau downwards, southwards.
Yeah, yeah. That's really important and interesting. And I think also highlights the importance, as you said, of looking, you know, at all of the available historical evidence we have. You know, sometimes all we have is the text, but when at all possible, looking at material evidence, sculptures, looking at inscriptions, epigraphy, looking at paintings and visual culture. And I think one thing that has been unique about your work actually is, although you, I think, identify as a philologist, you've been pretty innovative in kind of reading across those disciplinary lines, bringing in art historical sources, bringing in ethnography. I guess that's always been there for you. You want to say anything about that and why that's important in your work?
With the ethnography or the art historical, or both?
Let's just say both. Just kind of looking beyond the texts with the text.
Well, I think to sort of quickly cover the ethnography bit. I mean, I think that's, to me, that's always been obvious, but also it's been a sort of what's that? There was the journal started by Louis Dumont and Pocock in the 50s, wasn't it? And I think the first thing they said was that we believe that the firmest foundation to Indian sociology I'm going to get this wrong, but anyway, basically they say that you've got to combine textual studies with ethnographic studies. You know, that's the way to proceed, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, obviously sometimes, many traditions, you haven't got that option, but where possible, I think it's crucial. Secondly, so the art historical stuff, well, that's, you know, it's good fun as well, and there's beautiful objects, and on another level, on a basic level, you know, I'm fascinated by the subject. Spent the last 20-25 years trying to make sense of the history of yoga, and I will take whatever I can get. You know, there's not that much stuff out there, and so you know, you've got to use every source that's possible. I don't know there's any other. In fact, you mentioned epigraphy. There's actually, it's slightly disappointing, epigraphy. I don't think there's almost nothing that pertains specifically to Hatha Yoga within epigraphical sources. We can sometimes stuff about, you know, particular monasteries where we think they were practicing Hatha Yoga, but I haven't found, you know, there are quite a few inscriptions, particularly from Karnataka, that mention that the head of a monastery was a great yogi, but they never, and sometimes they, you know, they say that he was an expert of Ashtanga yoga, and sometimes might even mention some tantric siddhis, but I'm yet to find one, you know, that specifically identifies any Hatha yogic practices. So that then leaves with the art historical sources, and they, I mean, I think they corroborate very nicely the textual record to some on the one hand. So yeah, one of the big discoveries of the project that I don't know if Daniela talked about when so I haven't listened to her podcast yet. I must do. I haven't been listening to many podcasts during lockdown. I normally do it when I'm traveling.
You haven't been listening to the Yogic Studies podcast, Jim?
I'm sorry. I don't, yeah, too busy. Too many bloody emails to answer. anyway. But one of the big discoveries was with Daniela quite early on again. So it's quite lucky actually to make the big discoveries early on. If we made them now, but yeah, God, there's not much chance at the moment of making any big discoveries. But we've came across this decorated gate in Gujarat, a place called Dabhoi, the Mahudi Gate. And I subsequently did a bit of work on it. I haven't published anything on it. It's terrible. I've got reams and reams of notes on my computer. But I'm pretty confident in pinning down the date of its construction to almost exactly 1230. And it's covered in images of deities and famous siddhas, you know, master yogis from the Nath tradition. But also on its ceiling, there are 84 yogis, of whom 15 or so are in kind of non-seated, you know, balancing postures. So they predated, and prior to that, the earliest ones we knew about were probably late 15th, early 16th century, the including the many depictions at Hampi, Vijayanagara, that you've worked on and published on. So that was a big discovery, and that kind of quite nicely ties in with, I haven't actually yet managed to, I mean, it might be might form part of a proposal for another research project. So I think it's that important, and someone needs to work very closely on this gate to try to make sense of, because it clearly comes from a tantric Shaiva tradition, but exactly which one or what text it relates to is not yet clear to me. Mm-hmm. But I think what's interesting is that it dates to pretty much the same time as we first start seeing complex, you know, non-seated postures appearing within the textual record as well. So they sort of corroborate one another. And also I think that confirms to a great extent, yeah, another discovery of the project, or I mean a discovery, I don't know if it's quite the right word, because it's more of a thesis that I've been working on, is that this focus on physical methods of yoga, which are previously, and I think I kind of argue for this in my Khichri Vidya thesis in my book, is that I thought that these practices have been going on for a long time, probably as way far back as the Buddha, and then for some reason they suddenly get written down about 1,000 years ago. In fact, now I'm now more and more convinced that no, something new happens about 1,000 years ago, and these practices appear in India. There seems to be some connection, certainly, with the ideology, you know, the kind of yogic physiology. There seems the parallels with Taoist inner alchemical practices in China, which we first see codified a couple of centuries earlier. The parallels are too strong for there not to be a connection. But the that's in the theory, but in the actual practices, there doesn't seem to be so many, if any, parallels really. So that's a big question that remains, is why do these practices suddenly appear? Why do people suddenly start standing on their heads as part of yoga, or, you know, balancing in a lotus position?
Big question.
But then, so that...
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so that, you know, on the one hand, the art historical record can bolster, you know, inferences we make from reading the text. But then on the other hand, and I think, you know, your work points to this as well, we see in Hampi, for example, all these amazing contortionist postures that texts of that period are not telling us about at all. So right. It also reminds us that the texts are only giving us a very partial picture of what was going on. And that leads me on actually to, I think, where we may find a bit more on these things is perhaps in some of the vernacular materials. They may tell us a bit more about what was going on. You know, I think with this project, we've pretty certainly the early period, I don't think there are any, I don't think there are any Sanskrit texts on Hatha Yoga methods that we haven't really worked closely on from the pre 1400, 1500. I suppose the Chandravalokana is a relatively short, only 30 verses text. That's probably quite early, pre Hatha Pradipika. And we're not publishing an edition of that anyway. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I think most of the Sanskrit corpus has been covered. But it may be that there's more to be learnt from vernacular texts, of which there are some. And if I'd known this in advance, I'd have written a bit of that into the project. But that's a kind of an exciting possible future avenue. And I've got, hopefully I might have a PhD student coming to work on some of that stuff.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue into my next question. We're coming to the end of this conversation, so we'll start to wind things down here a bit. But I wanted to ask you, as yoga studies as an academic field and discipline continues to grow, and I think has a lot of momentum right now, thanks in no short part to your work, to your colleagues in this project, we're having more and more graduate programs, MA programs in yoga studies developing, like at SOAS. We're having new generations of graduate students kind of coming into this field, this line of work. So I wonder if you have any recommendations for younger students, prospective graduate students who might like to engage in this type of work, and any advice you wish you could have told yourself at the beginning of all of this.
So the first question of what, so advice to graduate students about, future directions in yoga studies. Well, I think, it's quite niche, I suppose, but certainly looking at some of these texts in southern vernaculars, so in particular in Marathi and Kannada, and also in Tamil, if there's any students out there who know Tamil or are learning Tamil, there's this text called the Tirumantiram, which is absolutely fascinating. I mean, I only read it in translation, but I find it's amazing, and I really hope someone does some serious work on that. And there's these vernacular texts in Marathi and Kannada, which are clearly very important for understanding the early history. And I may be having Amol Bunker, who's a Marathi scholar. He may be coming to work with me at SOAS.
And Telugu as well.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Kannada. Telugu, of course. Sorry. Yeah, I missed that out. Absolutely. Yeah, Telugu, very crucial. So I think that's a key field. I mean, of course, yoga studies is way bigger, even though I'm mainly really obsessed in this bit, but there's so much going on now. I mean, there's this amazing sounding conference coming up, isn't there, about the sort of problems that have been going on within yoga teaching in the West. And so there's plenty to choose from. But in my world of textual and historical studies, I think those are the promising fields. Amol is also going to be looking at the material, art historical record in Maharashtra, of which there's quite a lot still to be learned, from which there's a lot to be learned, I think. What else? Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think in Tibet, actually, I think Tibetan would be a good language to use. In fact, I've got another potential PhD student who wants to work on Hatha Yoga traditions in Tibetan. Mm-hmm. I think if people are interested in the early history of Hatha Yoga, I'm sorry, but I think we've done most of the Sanskrit work. I mean, there's no way you could say that about, Tantric Shaivism or anything. That's right. Why it's a very different feel, in that the corpus is, certainly these early corpus is really quite limited. And in terms of, what advice would I give myself? Gosh, I often say to myself, with everything I've done, even making films, for example, that if ever I'd known how much work was going to go into it when I started, I'd never have started in the first place. What advice would I give myself?
Would you have done it all over again?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. What I have no idea. Going forward, I'm not so sure, but let's see.
Yeah, So Jim, you're writing up the monograph. You're also in the finishing stages, I think, of editing some of these Sanskrit texts in this Hatha Yoga corpus, as well as producing English translations. When can our listeners anticipate holding in their hands any of the texts, the books that are going to be part of the output of this fabulous Hatha Yoga project?
I would say I'm reasonably confident that the first books will be appearing by the middle of next year, I'd have thought. So probably within a year's time. Mm. Yeah, like you say, I'm finalizing, but there's still, of course today I just realized there's another manuscript I need to collate of one of the texts, the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra. But that's it, I think, pretty much done all the collating, the editions and translations are in pretty good shape. It's just, topping and tailing them, introductions. And then they're all going to get published out of Pondicherry. I'm hoping at some point to, they're going to be very, philological, heavy critical apparatus, all that. So I'm thinking I want to produce some slimmed down versions of just brief introductions and text and translation with not much in the way of notes, but that will probably be a secondary project after completing the main editions. But yeah, hopefully.
And I think you mentioned in the course, is it true that the editions, those will be open access and so made available freely to download?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all the project outputs have to be open access. Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, in fact, all our data, everything we've amassed. I mean, we're in the process. So one of the things we've been doing is I've been doing it myself for decades, but also we've had research assistants helping us out typing in texts at great length. So we've got about 75 transcriptions of Hatha Yoga Sanskrit texts to dump online at some point. They're nearly in shape.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's a great resource for the public, but especially for yoga scholars to be able to immediately access all of those texts with a quick search and find. It's really revolutionized this type of scholarship.
Yeah.
And well, thank you for doing that. And for all of your work, thank you for sharing a bit of your journey and this exciting research with us today. Any final thoughts or anything else you wanted to say but didn't have a chance?
Well, I'd say thank you, Seth. And it's amazing what you're doing. You're doing fantastic work to promote all this, to get the word out there. We'll probably be, next future grant applications saying, well, yeah, I did a podcast for yogic studies. I did a series. That's really got it out there. Look at how many people are listening to that stuff. Because, yeah, you're doing a fantastic service. And I know it's tough. I know you have these days at the moment, we're all spending too much time in front of our screens, but you do a huge amount of work to promote your courses and everything you're getting out there. So really, I think, I'm very grateful that you've given not just me, but others, and hopefully you'll get Mark and Jason on some point, but to promote them.
Definitely.
The work we've been doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jim. It's
always your own work, of course, as well. I'm looking forward to, Seth hasn't mentioned, I'm on his supervisory committee for his PhD. So should be chivying you along there as well.
Yes, I'll try to get you some chapters here soon, Jim. Apologies for that delay, but the podcast and yogic studies has really taken off. But it's only taken off because of, the amazing work of scholars like yourself and the broader public interest in it. So we're grateful for listeners and for the interest and support in these studies. And may it continue beyond the Hatha Yoga project.
I hope so. I'm sure it will. Yeah. No, I'll never stop studying this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Jim. Well, please take care. Stay healthy, stay well. And we'll touch base soon, okay?
Yeah, and you. Thanks, Seth.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.